of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. Today's episode is episode number 193. It's a GDPR radio session, which is more of an open format where we kind of discuss anything in the news, any sort of cases and scenarios that we've kind of come through throughout the week, and any sort of any legislation updates and things like that, really. So really is quite a formal chat. I was joined, as ever, by Mr. Phil Brining. Good afternoon, Phil.
Hello, Joe. How are you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks. And we was joined this week by a returning host, hopefully more to come in the future, Miss Katarina Santos. How are
Hello,
you?
Phil.
Very formal introductions today, Joe. I'm not used to that with Jasmine. But,
no, she's not as formal as me, is she? But how did we find the session, guys?
I liked it. I thought it was good. I thought we had a good chat about stuff and got into some detail on some, you know, interesting topics. What did you think, Kate?
Great session, as you said. We kind of didn't go into too much kind of like variety, but where we did talk about, actually, you know, it is, we did cover quite a lot of variety. We touched on audits, we touched on cookies
talked
at one
a lot
point.
About audits.
Yeah. Mm. Breaches came up as always, the pecker came up, direct marketing. Yeah, I thought it was a great session. It was as chaotic as always, a little less so without Jasmine, a little bit more of structure to it. But no, yeah, I thought it was a really, really good session. Any highlights, any mm-hmm. highlights from anyone?
I think sorry, Phil, go on.
No, you go on, because you...
Yeah. No, I was just mentioning the fact that we talked about also the targeting in the advertisements and namely the LinkedIn that was found by the Irish... the commissioner. It was quite interesting to see what would be the lawful basis, and also we dig in around international transfer scenario. Probably derogation could be applicable.
Yeah, you know, I love the audit stuff anyway, so I quite liked it. I know it was a bit of a soapbox, but I liked that, you know, thinking about talking about the audits and the, you know, there's quite a bit we talked about in that respect, because we talked about how thorough does a DPA need to be, and an LIA. Talked a bit about due diligence on that I'd been doing on Zoom, you know, refreshing change to see some really good information to help us. So I think they were the kind of the highlights for me, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I echo those points. And without giving too much away, we shall leave you to it and let you get stuck into the podcast. And we'll see you next week. Hi, the host, Phil Brining. Good afternoon, Phil.
Hello, Joe.
Hello. And we are joined this week by a returning, hopefully new host, Katarina. Hello, Katarina.
Hello, Joe. Thank you.
A very chaotic and quite poor intro, to say the least.
I thought it was very good, Joe.
Thanks, Phil.
Good job.
But... yes, I don't know where to start, I guess.
I think you did an excellent intro, but I will pick you up on one thing that you
go
said.
On.
You know, we hope it helps people. Well, we do hope it helps people. We're not here, kind of. It's a community event, sort of self-help and chat. And it's really easy to just chew in the fat and relevant data protection stuff, isn't it, on a Friday
it
afternoon?
It is. Like three DPOs down the pub having a pint is what you've always said,
exactly.
I believe.
Exactly, yes. That's exactly
so,
what
yeah,
it should
so
be like, yeah.
Just to put it out there before we do get started, these are not particularly formal. They can be rather chaotic, can't they? But, you know, we like to keep it that way, so they're not kind of just boring that you often see with some data protection podcasts.
So what have you been up to this week, you two?
Joe, could do on
time. Right, yeah, put me on the spot.
I'll tell you what I mean, right? I've spent 3 days virtually solid reviewing audit evidence from last week's audit. Because there's a lot of documents that, you know, we didn't see, and lots of questions that arose when you read a document and it refers to a different organization and the ROPA says you're a processor for somebody, and you think, oh, that I haven't seen that anywhere. So following up a load of stuff and then writing up the audit report, which it's gone because we have to, you did the audit train, Jess, if you're interested in your in your thoughts on this, but we've actually both did the audit report that I've written, which you've started reading, Joe, is like virtually 50 pages long, and most of it is evidence and kind of a positioning statements around, like, this is what we found, you know, and this is objective evidence what we found. And we've had feedback that it's boring to look at and it's hard to read. So I put an exec summary in the front, which is only like a page and a half long, which goes through every area with an overview, which is really what I think most people will read. But the EPO, the practitioners, need to know the detail. They need to go and find what we've found and recreate that scenario, you know, in order to understand and to fix some of the stuff that we've highlighted. So I can't see how you can get around having you know, a long report. When you're looking at 20 different topical areas, you're looking at privacy notices, you're looking at lawfulness, you're looking at transparency, you're looking at rights, you're looking at everything. How can you do that report back what you've found and in any less? You know, you can report back on the compliance. You could literally just put a little colour chart in, but I don't think that's particularly helpful.
No, I don't think you can. And second to that as well, you know, if you were to come under scrutiny from the ICO and they were to ask if you've done any audits and probably demonstrate what methodology you've undertaken and your findings, if you were to provide them with just two pages of an executive summary of not compliant, compliant, not compliant, you know, they're going to be like, well, where's your evidence to determine whether, how have you come to that conclusion? So, yeah, I think you're right, Phil. I don't think there is, unfortunately, any way round other than doing how we do it, unless anyone in the chat's got any sort of ideas.
They've got a great idea. They've got an absolutely belting idea, which is to do an episode from the pub.
Yeah, I saw that.
I'm well up for that. I think it'd be great if we could find a friend. Like, we could go across the road to the brewery.
I think they would probably let us do that, yeah.
That'll be good. To be honest, that was a question that was raised in the training, wasn't it, Joel? Like, how can we just produce like a report on audits and in the meantime produce something that people will actually read? Considering all the evidence, so it's a balance between all the stuff.
It is, and that's the thing, isn't it? It's a balance between, you know, in some areas. I mean, you're also, it's quite easy for these audit reports to come across as quite negative because the focus is on things that aren't right and the corrective actions to fix it. But, you know, you've got to put in the good stuff as well. So, you know, in this particular case where we were last week, you know, the way they handled particularly subject access requests, but rights in general, was really good. You know, it was very detailed. It was very time consuming. It was very thorough. And the person looking after it, you know, knew what they were doing.
Did you use the ICO accountability, the new framework?
No, I didn't. I looked at using that. And honestly, I thought it was going to be too difficult, too rigid. I don't know what you thought, Joe, because you were sat in observing the audit. So, you know, I don't know if you thought that we could have followed that. It's such a rigid flow.
I've not really seen it, but I think the way that I don't think you can kind of have, like, I know you can, I think in my opinion, I've obviously only been on one and going to go on one next week, but I think even though you might set a criteria of things to cover within an audit, everything kind of intertwines with each other, doesn't it? So it's kind of like, you know, you look at your ROPA and that covers your, you know, your purpose limitation. You could look at data accuracy, you could look at international transfers, you can look at retention impact assessments, retention. So, and that's just one such a small piece. They all kind of intertwine, and I think often you find yourself, as we do on here, is that you talk about one thing and then another thing comes up, and it's just kind of like, I don't think you can kind of have, I think you can have like a skeleton structure to kind of prompt you, but I think you're often going to tangents, the checklist, but I've not seen the trackers, but if it's kind of really quite regimented, then
the specific questions to ask.
And
you ask a question, but the trouble is you get, I mean, it was a highly complex organisation we were at last week. You know, it's got multiple legal jurisdictions. It runs operations in British Overseas Territories. Well, you know, just double checking what everyone's understanding was a British Overseas Territory.
We spent quite a bit of time, didn't we, trying to find out what was actually meant by that.
So because I mean, Bermuda, Gibraltar, these are all places with their own data protection laws. Mm-hmm. So UK GDPR doesn't apply. So,
but then,
you know, do you need a representative out there?
Yeah, I don't know.
So it was very complex. And they've got retail, they've got the fundraising. It was a charity. They've got retail, they've got fundraising, they've got donations, they've got legacies, they've got thousands of operating units, 25,000 operating units in the UK, operating sites,
and
hundreds of thousands
as well.
Of volunteers, and members. They're a massively complex scenario, particularly with the structure. Well, you try getting the answer to a simple question like, is it registered with the ICO? Well, there actually are multiple entities.
Which one?
and there was 56. So of the 25,000 units, let's call them individual units, there was 56 registered. on the website, and there was two of the charity's entities registered, but not their trading company, and then not this other organisation. I found that on their ROPA they said they were a processor for, the trackers are great for, as a prompt, and they're well structured, and they've obviously been well thought through, so they're a really good resource. But I found it. I thought afterwards, I'm not sure I could actually, and it's Excel. I'm not sure I could actually get it into an Excel sheet very easily.
I do agree. I had a brief review a few weeks ago. I think there are quite interesting questions there that we can probably use for the future and from some guidance, but probably the use of the Excel for these complex organizations will be just hell.
You print it out on Excel, you know, and it doesn't do pagination very well, does it? And because you've got a big box of text here and a little box of text there, it just can potentially look a complete mess. So I prefer to use a Word document. You've got much more control over the style and the impact, you know, even headers and the style sheets, you know, different size fonts and labels and things, indentations. I just think it makes it easier to read. I mean, what you were saying, Joe, is that we should be moving towards PowerPoint. But I thought, how the hell are you doing in PowerPoint? It's even more woolly. Kathy was. Kathy
I was
going to
say, I don't remember Kathy saying that.
fine. So you don't. Sorry. I thought for a minute you were Kathy there, actually.
Thanks, Phil.
Anyway, what did you rambling? This week?
My week has been, as always, all over the place. Monday I did quite a lot of admin stuff. Kate actually asked me to review a couple of Pricepolar templates that she created. Had to review a couple of blogs to go out on the website, help the support desk with a couple of queries, really quite a lot of admin-y stuff. And then I've also been supporting some of my customers. I've had another really quite interesting scenario from one of my customers. Actually, I want to talk about it in further detail a little bit later on. My week's been a little bit bitty. And then yesterday I spent half of the day prepping for the audit that we've got on Monday, Phil. And then I'm going to spend the rest of today's afternoon after this session finishing off that, hopefully, before we travel down to Kent on Sunday evening. So yeah, a bitty week, to say the least.
That's a good one.
What about you, Kate?
What have you been up to apart from carving pumpkins?
A lot more interesting than that. I had a few meetings with clients, catch-up meetings, ROPA, and preparing for the cookie audit that myself and Kane are preparing for our clients. It's been quite challenging, but really, really interesting. I've never been able to do a cookie audit before, and never used OneTrust as well. So it's very new for me, and it's been really nice, to be honest. I'm really enjoying it. Hard, but good.
What are your thoughts on OneTrust, Kate? I know you might not have used it, you know, much, but not many people. I think, you know, me, Kane, you, there's.
Or
you know,
cookie
what
audits?
Just in general. I guess the cookie audits is quite a very small component, isn't it, of the capabilities of OneTrust. Yeah. But I'm intrigued to hear your thoughts on it, if you have any.
Yeah, I mean, what happened was our client already had all the cookies available in the OneTrust. You are able to see a graphic about all the cookies, third parties, first party, third parties, unknown cookies. How much are they? What type of cookies they are? Any forms, any tags, any pixels. So it's like a graphic, and then they, if you want, you can just add more detail and see more in further detail what they up to. You can export all this information to an Excel that I believe that was the same thing that you had previously for your cookie audits together with Phil. And I think it's really straightforward. I think the fact that they have a graphic rather than have just information is quite useful, and helped me a lot. I use the graphics to create the mythology, so I think it's easy for the client as well to understand where you were up to and what is happening in their websites. I think it's quite useful.
I do like the visual side of things, but Phil, we found limitations, didn't we, earlier in the year when we just in terms of kind of the output of the cookies that it found, it was inconsistent across the reports that were provided to us, but me and Phil didn't set the criteria in terms of the cookie scans. So you know, they could, okay, the limitations could have come from the tool not being used properly, or mm-hmm. you know, just because the tool doesn't. I mean, there were still questions around the actual tool, wasn't there, Phil? Because they have a database. Was it 300, was it million cookies?
It was a few million,
and,
yeah.
And yet there was cookies in the report that was unknown, and we could find out quite easily, couldn't we, Phil, what that cookie did by a Google search. So it just kind of raised questions. How are you not knowing what MS Clarity does in terms of the cookies in your database when all you've got to do is kind of do, you know, just quick Google and you find out the purpose of that cookie.
Do they actually needed it?
Cookie? Good question. I can't remember, to be honest.
I can't remember.
No. But they did say they were going to make some changes, didn't they, Phil? I think you raised that a few months ago.
Yeah, well, I sat on a few. I mean, what they're good at is putting out, you know, information about the use of their tool. So I sat on a couple of WebExes and seminars about the cookie crawler tool that they've got. I can't remember what it's called. Not cookie crawler. But and they did say, the trainer did say, you know, they recognise it's got limitations, they're going to release a new issue of it. This was probably in the summer, sort of July, August time. So that's probably out there now. So that it could be that it's improved. But we spent a lot of time, James has highlighted consent manager, which is really helpful. But Joe and I spent a lot of time early part of the summer looking at a bunch of different tools. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't actually find anything as good as OneTrust, despite its limitations. All the other scanning tools, and I went down to InfoSec and a couple of events, and I went and literally every stand, and I can you do this? Yeah, we can do that. No, they can't, you know. They're just, you know, and what they can do is they can scan for vulnerabilities, they can scan for scripts to comply with the PCI DSS, but most of the tools, none of the tools we looked at could do a decent job on cookies. They couldn't really find them, and they couldn't find them below the first layer. They couldn't find them in tag managers and things. And then they weren't able to categorize them. They weren't able to link to information about them. So as a comprehensive tool, OneTrust is a good comprehensive tool, but there are holes in it. So if you rely on it, you say, oh, don't worry about it, we're compliant, we've got OneTrust, you might find that but every time you click on a cookie and you expect to see a description about it, it says we've got no information about this. So you kind of need to do your own audit of your audit. Cookie audit in order to check that it's actually what you think it is. The other thing that the OneTrust tool didn't do when we used it was it wasn't able to categorize pixels or anything other than cookies. So any tags, pixels, images, etc. It found them, thousands of them. But again, you're not really sure what they are.
It's not really useful, is it?
Are they actually images like a logo, or is it actually a tracking pixel?
That's true.
But I mean, you know, it's good that we've got some tools, and they'll only improve as well, you know.
Yeah, especially with the emergence of AI and how quick that's rapidly evolving as well.
So what I've done is I've got this concept manager that James recommended, and I've pointed it at the website we did the review of, Joe. So again, we'll see what you come back with. It's good to have like a control, you know, test, you know, control. We know what we found there. We want to trust us. So we're fine. Anyway, what's been in the news then this week? Anything exciting apart from the budget?
I'm not sure you call that exciting. I found very little. I mean, the biggest story I think I found was the Irish regulator. Again, of course, it's always the Irish Data Protection Commission, isn't it, issuing out fines. They fined LinkedIn this time €310 million for GDPR violations. Specifically, breach the rules on legal basis under Article 6 of the GDPR and the sub-principle of lawfulness under Article 51A of the GDPR, as LinkedIn relied on invalid consent to process third-party data of its members for behavioural analysis and targeted advertising, and relied unlawfully on legitimate interests and contractual necessity for its processing of first-party personal data of its members for behavioural analysis and targeted advertising.
Now, you want to talk about that, don't you, quite a lot today? Type of thing, lookalike audiences
and targeted ads. I do, because it's something that I've only really kind of been exposed to recently, and I'm finding it quite tricky to kind of not manage. But I think when there's quite a few different lawful bases could apply, I think it's always devil in the detail, isn't it, of which one's going to be the most appropriate. So I do want to explore. I don't know if is it natural to kind of go into that now, or
let's just come back to that, because we'll probably end up talking about it a lot. I don't know if you saw the ICO, John Edwards put a blog out about the impact of breaches, which I thought was really good actually, and they've produced some posters. You said you'd seen them, Joe. I'd not seen them. And I'm going to share my screen because, I mean, they're freely available and I think they're really powerful. So I'm hoping that, you know, people kind of get them and print them out and stick them up in the workplace in order to, you know, just hammer home the point that, you know, it might be a temporary blip for us and something we think, oh, you know, this is a bit of a pain in the neck, you know, but we'll put a few patches in and then we'll be over it. You know, these posters are kind of highlighting the lasting damage that our temporary little admin blip, you know, might create. So again, I'm only highlighting it because people probably have seen it, but if they haven't, I'll put a link in the chat so you know, we can download and print them off, stick them around, you know, send them around to our teams just to try and, you know, this awareness raising. You know, last week we were talking about training, weren't we, with our client in the audit, every 3 years. You know, that seems very infrequent. And no awareness raising in between. But this type of stuff, again, is quite good for that. So I saw that in the news. That was good, the ripple effect of data breaches. And John Edwards' blog was pretty good to read as well. So I put a link into that.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. Have you seen in the chat that PSNI, they really like to be in the news at the moment, don't they? Cara has highlighted that police officers were viewing body cam footage. Just give me a second, I've just got the link in front of me. More than 70 police officers of the PSNI watched body-worn video footage of a drugs arrest for their entertainment and amusement, an investigation has found. This was between 2019 and 2022, including one officer who watched it 21 times. Lack of awareness apparently around that. But, you know, I know we talk about kind of like AI and facial recognition and so on quite a lot on here, but I think the concerns are not necessarily around the actual thing itself, but more kind of people abusing it, and, you know, in this scenario, you know, using it for a purpose outside of the scope it was originally intended for. You know, I think facial recognition can really be quite useful for police forces in identifying criminals, but I think once it kind of goes out the scope of that, that's where issues lie. And if it's used for things outside of that, you know, disciplinaries internally, for example, I think that's where you've got to be really quite careful in terms of using these sort of things.
I'm not sure if you've seen the Council of Europe Convention on AI. That's the UK, US, and the EU signed the first legally binding AI framework.
Oh right.
So I'll just put the link in the chat. But this new framework was agreed by the Council of Europe and commits parties to collective action to manage AI products and protect the public from potential misuse. And there is a explanatory report on this explaining all the significant benefits that AI can bring, but also this new convention will include important safeguards and mention all the risks and safeguards against these risks, such as, and in particular, the spread of misinformation and the using biased data, which may jeopardize any decisions. And it's very interesting as well, because this will be like a knight in front across the world, because they are not just inviting all the EU signatories countries or the European Economic Area, but also countries such as the US or Australia. So it's really interesting to see. And once this treaty will be ratified, let's see what happens.
See what happens. I tell you what, this morning I was doing some due diligence for one of our customers on Zoom. So this is about looking at their international transfers and everything. And I tell you what, Zoom have got some brilliant information on their site. It's so good to find. So I looked at Microsoft,
refreshing.
I looked at Salesforce, looked at Dropbox, looked at Zoom, I looked at WhatsApp. WhatsApp was the weakest, but Zoom, loads of information in a really to navigate a security center and legal center, a whole range of different very useful tools. A lot of them have got these self-access tools. Like if you download this and fill in your own details, then it becomes a legally binding, you know, agreement type thing, debt purchase agreement. But these big tech companies are really well geared up for making sure that, you know, we can do our due diligence from the desk. You can have a look at all the security stuff, you can have a look at all the transfers, you know, they're naming exactly where this data is going. Well, not exactly like down to the postcode, but, you know, it just makes it so much easier. It's a refreshing, because 2 years ago, I don't think this was here, was it? And there's actually a question on the Zoom FAQs. What's the best way to complete my company's supplier due diligence and or security questionnaire? And then there's a load of stuff about how to do it. Now, they want you to do it because they're proud of their security, you know. Yeah. And it's really nice to see.
Yeah, that's really helpful. I wish that all the contract suppliers would have something like that. It would make our life much easier.
Yeah. I don't think the team have been fined, have they? So, I mean, it's not the result of any regulatory action as far as I know. But, yeah, it's just a refreshing change. Just kind of log on and doing my desk research. I found, oh, this is it still took me an hour, you know. But it was because I wanted to get references. So when we come to review it next year, we can click on the references and see, you know, if as long as they're still live, what's there and what's changed. But it was good to see. So
yeah. What were your conclusion on the due diligence? Did you like it? What you see?
Well, I think to be fair, there's lots of different things that Zoom does and can be used for different products. But what customers are using it for, which is simply you know, communications and potentially recording information, I think it was satisfactory. I think there was, you know, not a major problem to use, you know. And what they got down here, the international data transfer. Zoom data transfer impact assessments, loads of them, you know, different scenarios in support in the Philippines, support in the USA, diagnostics data in the USA, EU website data, cloud recordings in the EU data center. There's one for all these different scenarios, a spreadsheet, in a workbook. And again, it's just well organized, easy to access, just nice change.
Your proud face.
Yeah, all my own work, none of my own work. No, it was good. Anyway, so you wanted to talk about, you said you wanted to talk about LinkedIn and Google.
Google Performance Max.
Performance Max.
But another thing about targeted ads, not LinkedIn though, but it is, I've been working with one of our customers. I mentioned it on here a few weeks back. They host events, and in doing so, they use third-party organizations to actually host it. So they put the event on, but they use third parties to host the sessions. And in this one particular scenario, the organization that's hosting the session for the event organizer, the condition of using that event area is to use their ticketing system. So I had questions previously about, you know, what's the relationship between the two, and we came to the conclusion that they're both independent controllers, because they're acting in their own interest, each determining the means and the purpose of the processing. However, after the event, the organization who's putting the event on, they want to receive data of those that are attending the session, because, you know, they see it as it's their session. They want information on the data subjects that have been there in order to, you know, do their own business activities, such as contacting for future events, direct marketing. And one of the things they wanted to do was to profile the people that have attended the events in order to do targeted ads. So this is kind of around looking at who's attended what events across the world and why they're not doing certain ones. And, okay, they've attended a tennis session here. They might be open to receiving marketing regarding, tennis equipment, for example. And I was under the impression that consent would probably be the most appropriate lawful basis, given that, you know, it's quite invasive, you know, profiling people to make assumptions about them in order to then send targeted ads. So we drafted a data sharing agreement for them. It was sent off to the third party who's hosting the session, and they changed the lawful basis for whatever reason to legitimate interest. And it kind of just stumped me a little bit. I just wasn't not that I wasn't sure, I was a little bit kind of like, okay, you know, could legitimate interest work as an appropriate lawful basis? So I kind of just wanted to kick the idea around on here that, you know, if you receive data from a third party who's hosting an event on behalf of you in order for you to profile and then send targeted ads, could legitimate interest work as an appropriate lawful basis, or would consent be the cleanest one? Now, just to give you a little bit of context as to why legitimate interest may stand up, is that when the data subjects purchase the tickets, there's a statement at the bottom that says, you know, by doing this, we will share your information with the organization who's putting on the event for the purposes of, and then the four things there are kind of listed saying what they're going to do once the information's been disclosed to them. And if you would not like us to share your information with this third party, then, you know, please contact us here and you can opt out. So I just, that made me think, because they're kind of being given the chance and they're being made aware of what's going to happen once the data goes, and they're given the chance to object to the processing, could legitimate interest work?
So how are these targeted ads actually delivered? Is it in a web or portal type platform or via email? I'm thinking Pekka.
Via email, as far as I'm aware. So, right. And I know that, but do you not think you could have two different level bases? So the legitimate interest in order to profile people, because you want to send target ads, but then rely on consent for the actual sending of the adverts.
Yeah, I mean, don't forget the ICO at some point has said that, you know, if you do something like, they call it sugging, isn't it? Where you, you know, do market research with the intention of compiling a list, then do direct marketing. They say that's all linked to the whole concept of direct marketing. So whether they would say actually that profiling is also linked, don't know. But I would have thought that you could get legitimate interest potentially to stand up for profiling. But I mean, Pete has raised a point about soft opt-in. Again, would that work? You're only allowed to promote your own services, aren't you? So it really depends, I think, on the detail of what it says in the privacy information. You know, what does it actually say in terms of what data is being shared with whom and for what purpose? And is consent, you know, obvious consent for that third party to use this information for marketing their own similar goods and services? I'm not sure. It sounds like there's too many failure points there for me.
Yeah. So what legitimate interest? Yeah, will probably be easier to kind of manage from a data controller perspective. Because you've, in my opinion, you've got the two things. You've got the sharing of the data from the event, the host to the event organizers, which will be legitimate interest, I believe, just for the sharing. And then once they've got that data set, they then become the independent controllers and they want to do these four things, you know, such as direct marketing, communications for future events, and profiling in order to then send targeted ads. So once they've got that data, yeah, you're probably right, aren't you? They're going to have to reach out to attain the consent and say, look, we want to use the information we've got from the host in order to build a profile around you and send you targeted ads.
Only if it's not been previously obtained. If consent's previously been obtained in the previous information being provided, then no, you know, but if it hasn't, it's not. The weakness, you know, the bit I'd want to delve into is, you know, what does that say? And have we got confidence that it gives that third party, the independent controller, the, you know, demonstrable ability and right to send the emails? That's what I'd be. That's the thing that would be my first starting point, because you don't have to send it by email. There's other communication methods they could use.
Yeah, they could ring you up, couldn't they?
Like,
they could do it by white mail. They could put it in a portal. They could do targeted ads on websites you visit. You know, there's a whole load of stuff they could do. You know, but email marketing, we know, is where the ICO levies most fines, and therefore that's the riskiest. They'll probably start looking at de-risking that and then working back, to be honest. But when your question was whether, you know, I was going to ask you a question then, a challenge, which is, so let's assume that, you know, you think that maybe you can use legitimate interest for behavioral analysis and targeted advertising. How does that sit with the Irish Data Protection Commission's view on LinkedIn then, that you mentioned earlier on?
Well,
but didn't they say there was, it didn't really work?
It wasn't necessarily around the consent. It was the fact that the consent they did have, they were relying on, was invalid.
No, they're legitimate interests.
Ah, sorry. Did I say that?
So the problem, the three things said.
Legitimate interests and contractual necessary for its processing of first party personal data of its members for behavioural analysis and targeted ads. I'd probably have to look at what they've said.
They said that LinkedIn's interests were overridden by the interest and fundamental rights of data subjects, you know, rights and freedoms. But that might, again, it's all context specific. That might be in the context of LinkedIn and what it's used for and what the privacy notice says. And then they've kind of debunked this, you know, oh, it's a contractual necessity for us to do this. Well, no, it's not, you know.
And I mean, what went through my mind around this is that if you're relying on legitimate interest rather than consent, then, you know, you need to make sure that data subjects are aware of what's going on. You know, they've been informed prior that this is, you know, by us sharing the info. So this is why I think legitimate interest could stand up, is because there's a statement at the bottom when they purchase the tickets that informs the data subjects that the information will be shared with the organization who's organizing the event for the purposes of profiling targeted ads, and it's given them the chance to object to the process and at that point. So I think, considering all of that, I think legitimate interest probably would work because of that first kind of initial, you know, I think the data subject would expect it to happen because they've been informed. So I think
is it a legitimate interest assessment to analyze here or not?
I asked them to complete one Wednesday, and it's been completed by somebody who I don't think's completed one before. So I've had an initial scan through it. I'm going to have to probably make some big amends to it.
And that was what we found at the order last week, wasn't it, Joe? Yeah. The policy of the organisation we audited, I'm sorry to dive on a tangent, but we'll come back to this, was the policy was that for whatever reason, all data processing activities had to have a DPIA undertaken on them. Well, what a cumbersome process that is. But the trouble is, the 208 DPIAs that had been conducted, and they were all on this DPIA spreadsheet and folders and things, but they were absolutely, well, most of them, certainly the other ones, absolutely rubbish. You know, the form that they were using, you know, it wasn't adequate. You know, the actual DPIAs, they didn't have any risk identified, you know, and it was lip service. So you might well get an LIA done on this, Joe, but, you know, how good is it? How critical is it looking at this? How, is it putting itself in the place of the data subject's shoes and saying, you know?
Well, that was what I said to them. I said, in order for us to understand whether legitimate interest would work or not, you're going to have to complete an LIA, and that will tell you whether it's, you know, balanced, proportionate, and necessary. But as you said, Phil, if it's not completed to the standard that it needs to be, then it's completely not pointless. It's pointless, isn't it, filling it out?
False sense of security. I did have a look actually. Again, this is what, you know, after, because we were being critical of it in this audit report. You know, I wanted to make sure that, you know, I could demonstrate the ISO had been critical of other people for their weak DPIAs, and I couldn't find it. Again, their database is really hard to use, because you'd think that maybe they were, one of the dimensions they'd put on the enforcement notices and monetary penalty notices was, you know, the kind of the topical area of GDPR or PECA that was the failure. So, you know, they don't have Article 35, you know, failure is one of the searchable criteria. So you have to go back, or try and use Google to find it. Anyway, I found Chelmers Valley High School and Serco, where the ISO had said, you've done a DPIA, but it ain't good enough. But I'm sure there's more that the ISO has said that about. So, you know, it isn't a completely weighted exercise, except it gives you a false sense of security and doesn't actually address the issues. And if you start to lean on it and rely on it, then, you know, potential wheels come off.
Yeah, and if the data subject was to complain to the ICO and they were to say, okay, how have you come to the assumption that legitimate interest is an appropriate lawful basis? Have you carried out an LIA and you showed them one that was just, you know, just not really sufficient in what it's meant to do, then, you know, you're not really going to have a leg to stand on. It's got to stand up to scrutiny, hasn't it?
Yeah, but who's doing that scrutinisation? You know, you need an independent, impartial body like us to do it. Who's going to ask tough questions like, you know, what do you mean contractual necessity? You know, the necessity balancing and all that kind of stuff. What do you mean contractual necessity? Show me why it's a contractual necessity.
Yeah, why?
But if sometimes you don't have people in the organizations that are going to ask those kind of tough questions.
We have a few cases and legitimate interest assessments that we need to review. We want to support ask, and we came to the conclusion that all the documents were completed in the eyes of obviously the organization and the organization interests. So all the individual's interests and all the point of the legitimate interest assessment was absolutely not included in there. So our job as an external entity was, okay, we need to do these questions, make sure that you actually address the problem here and don't overridden their interest in the end.
I'll bring you back to John Edwards' blog. He says, too many organizations fail to fully appreciate the harm they cause when they mishandle personal data. And again, I think that the DPO has got to be the champion. You know, they've got to get the balance right. You know, we are employees. You know, we have got a responsibility to our employer, but we've also got to try and champion the cause of the data subject and find that balance.
That's what I was about to actually add to that, Phil, before you said that, was that it's going to be the DPO, isn't it, that's completing the legitimate interest assessment. And it's important, I know you said it's good to have like an impartial view, but the DPO has to be impartial in this scenario. And the points you make are completely valid, aren't they, in terms of you're employed by the organization, so you're going to feel like you have not a debt to them, but you know, you might lean towards that way. But then is there not, I can't remember if it's in the GDPR, if it's guidance from the ICO saying that you can't really put pressure on the DPO to kind of go one way or the other. It's, they have to be independent.
You can't give them instructions. You're not meant to give them instructions.
He's independent.
Yeah. But I mean, that's a very hard balance to make. Into. I mean, Fiona, it's another good point. Yeah. You know, that if the DPO is potentially in the public domain through a FOIA, then you got to go. I'm going to talk about, there was an interesting ruling the first tier tribunal made a FOIA ruling this week about a university. I'll put a link into that because we haven't got time to talk about it today.
No worries. Did you have something you want to go down? Because we've, me and Kate, well, Kate's got a scenario that I want to explore before time. Time disappears.
Whatever. We'll go with the flow.
It might be right up your street because it's international transfers and potentially derogations as well.
Oh right. Yeah. Oh excellent. I'll get my quiz back out again. That was so popular the week.
It's a quite interesting one, and I think it's very practical. So me and Joe had a discussion with Suzanne. He's actually a Suzanne's client that. They are controller and they normally go to events and conferences trying to engage with potential clients. Normally these events and conferences are outside the UK and they share information aside from a portfolio, business portfolio. They share the CVs of their employees. So all the employees that will be or can be involved in the project, they will share all the CVs. So this will mean that they will share their names, their email addresses, their background, their experience, their job role, et cetera, et cetera. The biggest country that they normally go to is Dubai. So we asked, okay, so our first problem was, okay, do you actually need to share their CVs? For what purpose? Can you not just talk about what you do, selling your products, and obviously saying that you actually have like project managers with this all experience, 10 years experience, but aside from not sharing any personal data. And they came to the conclusion that we want to share because it's important for our business. And I think that can be or not, just correct me if you don't agree, like a purpose limitation and the principle of minimization problem. And the second one is in terms of international transfers. That is, if you are in an event or conference and you are actually selling a product and trying to engage with potential clients, sharing this information with clients that are based outside the UK and sharing employees' data, but they are not actually your clients, are they? They are potential. They can be or not be in the future. And they said, okay, but we can have the explicit consent from our employees. But I don't see explicit consent being here applicable. Not see if it will be freely given. For instance, there is an imbalance of power, isn't it? So we were just very stuck on this.
A little bit.
So just summarize. So you're at a conference.
Yeah.
And why? In Dubai,
and you're trying to engage with a new customer, and in doing so, they want to receive information about your staff and the qualifications matters. And experiences that they've got. So you've got their CVs in hand,
okay,
and you're in Dubai, and you're going to pass over to an organisation, but you're not in an agreement with.
So we're trying to win work in Dubai, and I'm at a conference, and I'm going to put Joe and Kate into this project because they are the bee's knees, and they say right, okay, send us their CVs. What's the
how do you share that information under chapter 5 of the GDPR? Because mm-hmm. international transfers and you know EU SDCs, are they not can you only enter into them once you're in a contract with that organization? Because are they not just an addendum to a contract? Or am I missing something?
So the question is, what is a potential lawful basis or the mechanism under Chapter 5?
Yes. Yeah.
What's a probably legitimate interest? That's all lawful basis.
No, yeah, lawful. Say that. We're saying
you talk about interest transfers, aren't you?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. What's the safeguard you can rely on to send data to Dubai?
I don't know. I forget. I haven't got a copy of the Data Protection Act here. I don't think.
So we just completely ruled out any sort of EU SECs and the addendum or international data transfer agreement because you're not actually in a contract with the organization. So how are you going to get them to sign?
I don't think you'd need to be in a contract, would you? You could have a data processor contract or data sharing MOU or something, couldn't you?
Perhaps. Yeah.
But will you do this with your potential clients? So because what the client said to us was, okay, but we are an event, so we want to engage with a potential client. We are actually selling a product, and we are using this information to add more value to our product. I don't want.
Okay,
we don't
so
want.
I'm saying come and buy from us because we've
yes,
got.
Yes, exactly. Because
Kate,
we have Kate and Joe and Phil in here. Yes. Yeah. And they actually are completely against to provide any sort of documentation for them to sign. But do you think that could be a viable solution, like having an agreement or a privacy statement or something?
Well, what I would say is that I'm sure that I could find a way through. I'm not entirely sure what it is now, but I think I'd have to draw it up and then work it out and what's going on, because I'm not entirely sure I've got a full picture of the scenario here. But you know, I think that it sounds to me like it's a sensible thing that should be able to occur. But you said minimization, you might not send all the CV, it might not be necessary. You know, what is it that they would need to see in order to make a decision to engage with us or not? You know, they don't need to know your hobbies and pastimes and what secondary school you went to do. They just need some kind of, all they need to know is what level of experience and qualification you've got, which doesn't, I mean, it's lazy to just send the CV over.
I do, potentially. And we did some digging in their website, and they actually have a section on about us where all the team with the names and the job roles are there. So our first idea could be, for example, advice on probably data anonymization, just sharing the relevant information. So our the years of experience, and that is like a leader project manager, and just link them to the website.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't suggest this without thoroughly going over it, but have you ever looked at the Article 49, kind of when all else fails?
Yes.
Yes.
I pointed it out to Kate yesterday.
Yeah.
So I remember using that once when I was working at Everton. We did, because it was there in the old 98 Act. I remember using that at some point, saying, well, this is a one-off, you know, situation. We're going to rely on this. But yeah. You know, it doesn't sound to me like it's something that you couldn't actually get off the ground. It's just a question of how you get off the ground, how you document it, and what checks you do, safeguards you put in place. Again, Fiona makes a great point. You know, if you're looking at recruitment companies, they don't tell you who the candidate is. I don't think it's from a data protection perspective. I think it's to stop you going and looking up on Facebook or LinkedIn and engaging with them
Yeah, sorry. No, I agree. But just to add a little bit of context, I believe the data subjects whose CVs would get shared are the founders, directors of the business. So
they are. Two of them are founders, and the other are just the associates.
Yeah. So sending the anonymized data, if you had job title and information, then that data could become non-anonymized by someone going in.
Yeah.
Digging on the website or LinkedIn, but then could you argue?
But it's always a risk, isn't it? It's just.
Yeah, but, you know, there's the fact it's the founders and the most senior people in the business is probably makes it easier to justify than it is if it's employees.
Agree. And it also came down, as I said to Kate yesterday, that, you know, you got to take maybe a bit of a risk-based approach here, that, you know, the risk of the data subjects is that they're unhappy that this happened, but they're not going to be unhappy, are they? Because they're going to want to win the work.
Well, so, you don't know. We don't know that.
Yeah. I guess not. No, I guess not. All right.
I mean, there might be somebody in your employment that you know is hiding something from you, you know, and they wouldn't want to get sent to Dubai to work. And you know,
I guess. Yeah.
I think it's too easy to generalize. But I do think if you were, you know, we have to step through it all. But I think there's probably a route through it.
Yeah.
Okay. More the questions than answers.
So sometimes, I mean, I'd like to draw these things out as a data flow, you know, so I understand what's going on, but I was replying to Peter's chat when you started off talking, so I missed the front part of it.
Oh, I have a very interesting case. I'm not sure if aside from the scenario, that's all right. So me and Joe were just digging around the podcast prep, and we came to this news that paid vacation parks have scanned their visitors' face so that the guests can gain access to pools and playgrounds. So this happened in Netherlands. The Dutch Data Protection Authority investigated these parks because they were using facial recognition to grant access to the facilities like swimming pools and playgrounds. Seven of these parks already made some measures to make sure that are not fined. One of them is still ongoing, is still on progress. But what was more interesting was we did more digging, and they wrote an article on this saying, so explaining that in general, facial recognition is prohibited unless the facial recognition serves only personal or also household purpose, security or authentication purposes, or if the person whose face you scan is explicitly consent to this. And in the end of this article, they state that this should be the option for assessing the swimming pools. So in this case, and I quote, in the case of assessed control for a swimming pool, option three, explicit consent, is the only possible option. A substantial number of requirements apply for the way in which an organization has to ask people for consent for applying facial recognition. But I'm not sure if I agree with this.
What's your thoughts then?
Just a little context. They already have a card or like a bracelet to assess the swimming pool. So they already have information about these users or of the swimming pool. And how do they manage consent in this situation? Because for me, I think the swimming pool, if I understood correctly, they are using facial recognition probably for more security purposes. So to see if anything happens. And I would say even substantial public interest could be interesting in this situation. But I'm not sure about explicit consent. And how could be this managed and withdraw consent or I don't know.
Well, technically you'd have to have a database of faces and names. And if somebody withdrew their consent, then you would mark it on the database, wouldn't you? And you wouldn't be able to use that image for the purposes of access control. But the question going through my mind is then would you need to keep the facial recognition image for on a suppression list?
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, what the ICO said here about Serco is it's a frivolous use of biometric data. You know, why would you use it for access control when you've got bracelets, armbands? Is it necessary? You know, and I think it's very hard to justify it.
Agree. Yeah, it baffles me why you'd even consider giving people access to swim pools by doing scans of their faces.
Yeah, and particularly because I'm assuming that obviously not even adults, but also children. So this is very weird, isn't it?
Well, I mean, if it was facial recognition for access into government buildings, you could, you know, maybe understand why they want to use that. But for a swimming pool where it's just
in a vacation park, yeah.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Seems to me it's just like, you know, completely technology for technology's sake, you know, and very, very hard to justify, particularly the biometric data piece of it.
Indeed.
Now, did you see you will have done? I know we're rapidly running out of time, but the new I don't get the joke here, but the new data use and access bill, the DUA bill, that apparently the ICO team are calling Dua Lipa. I didn't really get what's Dua Lipa.
Dua Lipa, she's a singer.
Oh, right. A singer.
All right, fine, fair enough. All right, okay.
But so, still, I don't really understand the joke.
Yeah. Anyway, so they're calling it the Dua Lipa bill.
But
quite interesting. We haven't really got time to get into the detail now. But did you see that this week? Then you know, the proposed bill, the new stuff, the change stuff, the withdrawal stuff from the old DPDI bill. Now I think this has got a chance of getting through. So I think we should focus on it. I didn't think the DPDI bill would. Which is why I didn't bother to read it very much. But I've downloaded a copy of this, 268 pages, and I'm going to read it because I think this will go through in some shape or form.
I found a very good blog from Chris Pound. I'm going to share it in the chat for people to read. It does summarise quite nicely what was in the DPDI bill that is no longer in the new bill. And then what's in both, I think, is... Yeah, so what is in the DUAB that was in the DPDI bill and what was in the DPI bill, but now is not in the new bill. So, yeah, really, really quite nice summary. We'll probably look to explore it, I think, at some point, won't we?
Mm-hmm.
As things change in it moving forward and it works its way through Parliament.
Well, I think we should have a session or two on it and really focus on it because there's some big sweeping stuff, isn't there? You know, the way that, you know, the cookies this notion now of spam to no one, you know, counting the gains to increasing the pecker fines, which I think we probably knew would going to happen. Some stuff on scientific research, changes to privacy notices, changes to SARS, you know, the kind of encapsulation of this proportionality is now will be, if it goes through, in the statute rather than it just being case law and guidance. So there's a lot of stuff, I think, to cover through, changing the name of the Information Commissioner's office. I'm not sure that's particularly material. You know, the legitimate interesting stuff and the things that have disappeared, you know, we're now preserved as a species. The DPOs aren't going to get scrapped and replaced by currently. That's a proposal. Record place activities remain. There's a lot of things that have been taken out of the proposed bill. But I think we need to have a session on it because I think there's going to be some good stuff to explore in there.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah.
I agree.
Well, you are right though, Phil. Quickly running out of time. I don't think we've got too much time to delve into any other news pieces. What are you guys on with next week? Anything exciting coming up?
Well, I'm heading down to Kent on Sunday with you to do a 9 o'clock audit in Kent.
Indeed.
That'll be a long day. And then on Wednesday, I'm jetting off to Ireland to do a PCI assessment for Kenne. Kenne can't get there, so she sent me. But it's right across the other side of Ireland, so it's a three-day round trip.
So when are you? What time are you back Friday? Are you here for the podcast next week, Friday? Or
no, I think I'm flying at 12.
Well, Jasmine and Kate are off to Budapest, so
yeah,
that leaves me on my own. So next week we may not.
Kane,
possibly, yeah.
Delve into the listeners and get some troops to chat about stuff.
If one of the listeners want to join me next week on a podcast, drop me an email or drop me a message on LinkedIn and we can have a chat.
The start of something big. Big and beautiful. So that's what my next week is all, apart from Tuesday, all kind of travelling and auditing.
Lovely. Busy week.
I know.
That's exciting. I am actually providing training on Thursday to one of our costumers about lawful bases.
Costumers?
Client, sorry.
Oh, I thought it said costumers. I thought, crikey, it was not there. What are you doing, Joe, then? Have you got something exciting on? Plenty on?
Only Monday, really. I've got something booked in, is the audit down in Kent. And then my week is quite free in terms of calls, but I'm sure people will email me with urgent queries that need to be done by the next day, as always happens. Yeah. But it gives me some time to catch up because I've been out of the office quite a lot over the past, not the week just gone, but the week before. Phil, me and you were out, weren't we, for 2 days, and I had a day of audit training. So I've not want to say neglected, but I've not had the time would like to put, help make sure my customers are doing all okay. So next week will be catching up.
You can get that DPIA finished off that I reviewed.
Yes, I can. Yes, finally.
I'm really excited
hopefully.
To read that DPIA once it's finished.
Until you see the size of it. Until you see the size of it. But I'm sure, I think we're going to explore that on a podcast, aren't we, on a session?
It's a good bit of work you've done, Joe. You know, it's thorough. It's, you know, what I like about it is it's taking a balanced approach. It's going, right, this argument's for, these are arguments against, you know, and on balance, we think this is probably the most viable scenario. And that's why I think it's a pretty good document, because it's not all, a load of old baloney, you know, like, oh, you know, we've done a legitimate interest assessment and it all looks fine to me. You've got counter arguments in the DPA, which again makes it, I think, a much more credible document.
Lovely. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate summary. But yes, it's been a lengthy piece of work, but it's worthwhile, isn't it? Because you need to make sure that you do it right. Otherwise, as we've said earlier, that it's completely completely ineffective. Amy says she likes your Michael Jackson glove, Phil.
Right, yes, I'll be. Yeah, no, yeah, I've got this.
You have to play around the golf.
No, I'm not. No.
Anyway, and on that note, we shall leave it there. Thank you very much for
doctor's orders.
Doctor's orders. Well, yeah, thanks to you, Phil and Kate, for joining us on another session. Thanks to all the listeners and everyone that's joined in. We will be back next week if I can manage to get Kane to join me on a podcast or if anyone else joins. And I think we're going to be talking about relationships, determining relationships. So, you know, controllers, controller, controller, processor, joint controllers, because it's really quite a tricky thing to do sometimes. Sometimes it's straightforward.
Well, should be fun.
You'll have to dial in while you're on your Ryanair flight home.
I will.
45 minutes, I think it is, isn't it? Just about.
It is to Newcastle, yeah.
So you'd only be able to do 3/4 of the podcast.
We'll see.
I just cannot join as well. Budapest life.
I'll hold you to that.
Right. I should use my Michael Jackson glove to wave bye-bye to everybody.
Probably. Cheers, guys.
Bye.
Thanks for joining.
Thank you. Later. Bye.
Bye.